The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We're at a grand financial experiment where central banks and central planners have tried to do things like this, never to this scale. But somehow we're convinced that because the scale is so much bigger this time around, that the result is going to be better. And I think that defines foolishness, and I think ultimately that defines a catastrophic ignorance, which will destroy people's finances.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you're not in the studio today with me because you have been in Oklahoma City. You've been in Houston. Some of the American energy capitals. I think it's interesting because we're seeing record volatility with oil right now, and it has huge ramifications, not just here in the United States, but worldwide.
There's been a major trend, Kevin, over the last several years, increased production here in the United States, utilizing our resources in a pretty spectacular way. Of course, you know that the increase in production has come from a change in technology. Hydraulic fracturing has allowed for very quick production. Unfortunately, very quick fall off as well in terms of that production. They're not continuous pools, but they do give us a short, sharp increase in supply to where now on a global basis, we have about 2 million barrels per day in surplus. That is a million barrels of oil per day. And a lot of that surplus has come from U.S. production. So you look at Oklahoma City, you look at Houston, these are boom towns where, you know, the cranes are out, the buildings are going, and, you know, refashioning the downtown area. Why? Because the money's flowing in a way that it hasn't since the last major boom in oil. Well, clearly, the volatility of the last several weeks and several months in particular, which really just sort of increased considerably this last week, have put the brakes on to some degree. Oil on Sunday night reached a low of 63.72. That's West Texas Intermediate. And Brent, which is traded more internationally, was a few dollars higher than that. But if you look at that, Kevin, that was down well over 13.5% in 1 week. Massive volatility for a market as large as the oil market.
Well, David, I remember a few decades ago that there was a behind-the-scenes war going on. You look at OPEC, you look at the Saudi royal family and how firmly they've been entrenched for decades as far as the controllers of the oil price. But this drop in oil prices, I mean, could it also be observed that this is maybe a price war where OPEC, they didn't cut production when they voted on it, and it basically is sending a signal that they're willing to produce at very low prices. Is that to force this U.S. increase in supply into the red?
I think that's a large part of the story. It's not the only part of the story, however. And what is important to recall, economics 101 has two variables, supply being one variable, demand being the other. And when you look at soft growth in the emerging market, soft growth in Asia, dipping into recession in Japan, the potential for doing so in China, looking at Europe, and clearly they're not out of the woods. Russia is on the cusp of recession. You can go around the world, and as you see a decline in economic activity, there's also a decline in demand for oil. And so that's the demand side, where there has been a fall off in demand for oil. At the same time, we've had an increase in supply. And the guys here in the U.S. aren't real interested in dropping their production. They need the cash flow. They've got huge debts to pay that they've used to finance these projects, and they need every penny they can get. Of course, they'd like a higher price. But, you know, when you put something into production, it's a little bit like when you've got a huge barge and you want to turn it in the water. You have to anticipate, and it may be 3, 6, 9, 12 months before you can really turn off the tap. And that's one of the reasons why the Saudis and OPEC are so critical in the short run in the oil market, because they're the ones who aren't working on new projects, but have old established fields, and it's very easy for them to increase or decrease supplies by 500,000 barrels a day, 1 million barrels a day, and make a major difference in terms of that glut of oil that's on the market as it grows on a per day basis. So the fact that in Vienna, OPEC did not decrease oil production sends a very loud message to the oil markets. And it's simply this: OPEC has declared a price war. They have much greater flexibility. And of course, when you're talking about OPEC, you're really talking about the largest contributing members, those in the Gulf states. When you get to the periphery of OPEC, they are suffering, but they're less of a substantive vote in OPEC. So Nigeria, less of a player, Venezuela, less of a player, even Iran. And these are countries that will suffer greatly with lower oil prices. But here's what's at stake. It's really quite simple. Market share for OPEC has shrunk to the lowest level in 25 years. And that's in large part because of the increase in U.S. production. U.S. supplies have been increasing, and yes, that threatens Saudi and OPEC market dominance. They still are 40% of total production, but again, they've been pressured, and they have the flexibility in terms of cost per barrel to see the price drop and continue to make money, hand over fist, quite frankly. That's not the same position that we're in here in the U.S. with considerably higher costs per barrel.
Well, and don't you think, Dave, that their power of retaliation, okay, let's say that retaliation of us replacing their supply with our own could also come in the form of currency. You know, we've really enjoyed sort of a gentleman's agreement. We scratch their back, they scratch ours, in that all OPEC oil has been traded in U.S. dollars. Now, what we're starting to see is we're starting to see agreements come between countries where they're bypassing the dollar with trade agreements. Now, could ultimately an upset OPEC affect the U.S. currency?
Let me add one thing to that, because, of course, we know our ability to finance our fiscal deficit has everything to do with running a trade deficit and thereby exporting dollars into the world, which causes what we've talked about in past shows as a recycling effect, where those dollars get reinvested by our trade partners. It shows up as a trade surplus on their part, and they take those trade surplus dollars and reinvest them or recycle them into U.S. debt issues like treasury bills and whatnot. You know, when we decrease our trade with OPEC countries and decrease the amount of oil that we import because of an increase in production domestically, it also decreases the surplus dollars that the Saudis and other Middle Eastern countries have to recycle into U.S. treasuries. So, you know, on the one hand, our trade deficit improves if you're concerned about a large trade deficit. But on the other, that trade deficit has been very critical to backdoor funding of our budget deficit.
Well, you know, we interviewed Richard Duncan a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the inputs that it takes to run this country on debt. And one of the key inputs, of course, was to run this trade deficit. You know, he sees that as critical. Otherwise, we have to print the money. We have to come up with that money somewhere to buy our own debt, don't we?
Yeah, and so there are some positive things to U.S. production, and that, I think, is intriguing. Estimates are that production is going to be flat in 2015. If it increases, it could increase to as much as, but no more than, 1 million barrels per day in addition to what we have now. Compared to the current daily surplus, that would be a 50% increase on the current surplus in the oil market. We would be going from a big glut to an even bigger glut of oil on the market. But as you say, there's pros and cons here. I think some of the things that are eventually destabilizing from a global standpoint is the implications that this has for the emerging markets, the implications that this has for non-OPEC countries like Russia. Russia is going back into recession as we speak. They have better than 50% of all their financial needs as a country taken care of by taxes on trade in oil and gas. And with the price of oil and gas being low and there being tensions with Europe, and now with a canceled pipeline project for Rosneft, which, you know, again, is disastrous for Rosneft, one of the largest gas and oil producers in the country. You've got basically an unwind financially in Russia like we haven't seen since 1998, when we did use oil as a bully club. We basically bankrupted Russia by driving the price of oil down. And what no one really notices since that time frame is the radical change in the ruble. In the last 3 months, the ruble is down 25%. It's down close to 50% since 2008 and 2009. And if you roll the clock back to when we were last putting pressure on the Russians via the oil market, I don't know if we are or if it's just circumstantially, then we don't mind it because politically it does help us in some ways. You look at the differential in currency from then to now, 1998-2000, that time frame, the exchange rate, dollar to the ruble, 5 rubles for $1. Now it's 54 rubles for $1. This is a massive devaluation.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Dave, as we look at this, we looked at each other when Russia went into the Ukraine, and we started saying, well, gosh, okay, forget supply and demand for oil, forget price wars, let's forget all of this. Let's just simply look at strategic. And what you brought out, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, driving the price of oil down to put Russia out of business. And then, of course, we increased our military spending under Reagan as well. So we increased military spending. They tried to do the same. And then we drove their main generator of income down to virtually nothing. You know, you've got geostrategic and political reasons to see that this would definitely be a power play. But let me ask you something. Is there anything that your gut says about a guy like Putin, who is in a corner, okay, economically he's in a corner, do you think he's the kind of guy who's going to do the best thing for Russia, or do you think he's the kind of guy that would push a button on a larger weapon at some point?
Yeah, I think you have to say you're not really dealing with a global player, in the sense that when you think of the move towards globalization over the last 20, 25 years, this is a guy with a strong sense of national identity. I don't fault him for that. It's just merely an observation. But what is his calculus? You know, what's going to please the global elite, or ultimately what's best for Russia? And that could end up being more of what we've seen with Crimea and the Ukraine, as we talked about with Richard Duncan just a few weeks ago. At this point in the deterioration of global finance, it's pretty normal to launch a war, a global war. And your war cycle studies, as we've discussed with Charles Minner, would also imply a world war right now. And to see some pressure on various currencies, to see pressure in the commodities market, which has a huge impact for all of your emerging market economies, which are very, very commodity price sensitive, you're dealing with greater degrees of social unrest at the periphery. And the real question is, when does that social unrest at the periphery move towards social unrest at the core, where your developed countries all of a sudden are seeing the same kinds of social upset and dissatisfaction with the status quo? I'm not talking sort of a Missouri-style social unrest, maybe more of what we see today in Hong Kong, but on a larger scale in Chicago, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, Rome, where, again, there's something of a revolt from the status quo, which is in decline, which is in deterioration. And, you know, it's one thing for the guys at the top to say all is well. I'm thinking of Japan this week. You know, not only did they get a debt downgrade, but a recent poll amongst Japanese, 70% say basically the economy has gone from bad to worse. Meanwhile, the guys who crafted Abenomics and this major monetary push, they're basically dislocating their shoulders, patting themselves on the back for what a great job they've done. So the Nikkei is up, and that's supposed to be some indication of economic recovery. No, that's just speculative dollars flying wild in the stock market, and it's not an indication of how well or how poor people are doing in the general Japanese population. So I think the great surprise for the global elite is going to be they've believed their own BS so long that when there is social unrest, they're going to be scratching their heads saying, but we felt we did the right thing.
Well, and I'm thinking about interest rates right now in Europe, Dave. I mean, talk about out of step with the dangers that we've just been talking about. The bond market in Europe right now is acting as if Italy can certainly pay their bills back. Greece, you name it, Spain. These interest rates, which are a measure of people's perception of risk of debt repayment, those interest rates are hitting record lows as we speak.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, if interest rates are an indication of risk, or classically that's what they have been, is a litmus test for risk in that particular marketplace, where an investor is demanding greater compensation for the inherent risk in that marketplace. Well, you would have to say that there's zero risk in Italy. You've got the Italian 10-year yielding less than 2%. And that, with debt-to-GDP figures of north of 130%, that's not normal. Spanish 10-year debt, 1.9%. There's something askew. Something is off. And it basically is the world's central banks trying to cover over and trying to print their way out of what Richard Duncan described as the ultimate financial endgame. And this is where you begin to see gyrations in the gold market and realize these stakes are so high. If you're concerned about the short-term price volatility, you just don't understand. We're talking about global finance and a system of market normalcy that we've grown accustomed to over the last 30, 40, 50 years, which is going the way of the dodo bird. We're not talking about a small cyclical correction. We're talking about something that could, you know, as we talked to Joseph Tainter, be one of those instances in history where you erase 500 years worth of progress. That's not taking us back to the Stone Age, but that certainly makes things a bit medieval. I fear that people overestimate not only central bankers' control, but they underestimate the extreme upside volatility in gold and silver when the general world population figures out that, no, Mario Draghi does not have the tiger by the tail. No, Janet Yellen does not have things under control. No, the folks in Japan printing like mad and claiming success are actually closer and closer by the day to complete implosion. And so it's curious to me, you know, you watched last week's price volatility, gold up 50 bucks, down 50 bucks. There is extremes in the marketplace because behind the scenes, you have no idea how extreme the desperation is. And so it's very easy for me to sit in a position with gold and silver, knowing that this too shall pass in terms of price volatility. If you understand the fundamentals, this is absolutely the right time, the right place, no better solution to the problems at hand. And again, it is for lack of wisdom and insight that the world goes headlong into things like Spanish debt, Portuguese debt, French debt. This is insane. I just came back from France. We're literally talking with French bankers. They're scratching their heads and wringing their hands. And yet 10-year treasuries, the equivalent treasuries in France, are yielding less than 1%, 0.97%. Absolutely insane. The Irish, they haven't solved their problems, and yet their 10-year treasury is 1.38%. I mean, this is absolutely nuts.
Dave, when you read stories of eyewitnesses of the Titanic, one of the things that was confusing, after they had struck the iceberg, the experts on the boat understood that that boat was probably going to go down within several hours. The people who were on board, however, didn't see really much activity as far as putting life jackets on, what have you. In fact, if you were on a boat and something had just happened and you didn't realize that it was going to be terminal, if no one was putting a life jacket on, you probably would say, well, maybe things are fine. That's what the central banks seem to be doing with the bond market right now. But I think you have to pay attention to who is putting their life jacket on. Okay, I'm going to use the Dutch as an example, Dave. The Dutch interest rates right now are paying less than 1%. I think it's 0.82, something in that range.
On their 10-year treasuries.
Yeah, but at the same time, the Dutch have done exactly the same thing that the Germans tried to do last year with their tonnage of gold that we hold here. You know, many European countries hold a lot of their gold here in America, but the Germans didn't get their gold back. The Dutch were able to repatriate, what was it, over 120 tons.
That's what they're working on right now, up to 122 tons requested. And this is the interesting thing. You'll recall the major price volatility, which began in 2011, was on the heels of the Venezuelans requesting their gold delivered to them.
What was that, about 100 tons?
I hate to say it, but it's as if the world of global finance still has a major underpinning of support in the gold market. And yet this is a place where not very many people have sort of dusted out the cobwebs and looked recently. Who owns what gold? What's been rehypothecated? Who actually has it in supply for immediate delivery? These are questions that haven't been asked for 20, 30, 40 years. And now that they're being asked, you know, it's like the question's asked and you immediately need a straw man. You immediately need something to distract attention and take away the pressure from those withdrawals. So seeing price volatility is actually becoming par for the course whenever central banks sort of act on their suspicions about the viability and solvency of their fellow central bankers. And I think that's really what's interesting is crazy price action and manipulations seem to coincide with central bank suspicions of one another.
Hmm.
They have a good reason to be suspicious of one another, and they have a good reason to want their hands on the stuff. Ultimately, I think the history books will show this. When we look back at this chapter in world finance and economic history, we're going to say whoever acted first, they were the smart ones. Whoever acted second and third and fourth, they acted too late and they couldn't do anything about it. There was nothing for them.
Well, and it's not just the Dutch, Dave. You know, the front runner for who may be the next president of France, she's also put together a request that France repatriate their gold. And so we saw the Swiss vote this weekend, and they voted against repatriating their gold. But what we're actually seeing behind the scenes is we're seeing the people who are making decisions without votes, when they don't have to vote about it, to repatriate gold, bring it back home. I think we should repeat that Germany had 1,500 tons of gold here in America. They asked for one-fifth of it back, which was 300 tons. This was last year. And we told them that it would take 7 years to deliver that gold. And only a fraction of that gold has been delivered so far. Publicly, they backpedaled, Dave. Publicly, Germany came back out. They realized that they may have let a cat out of the bag that was very dangerous to the world economy. They came back and they said, well, no, I guess it doesn't matter as much. We're fine with the gold in America.
Yeah, we'll see what letters exchange across leather-top desks in the Netherlands and who gets what threats to see if the Dutch also withdraw their request for 122 tons. I think this is high-stakes poker, and the world central banks are trying to keep a straight face, watch the beads of sweat on their brow, and I think that says a lot more than what they say they have in hand. You know, what we're watching in Switzerland is very interesting. I think whoever drafted the legislation did so as a perfectionist. They did so as an idealist, and that's unfortunate because had it been worded differently, I think it would have been far better received. You know, you had the idea of moving their currency reserves to up to 20% in gold, and then they added to the legislation this very important little byline. And then from that point forward, you may never sell those gold ounces. And again, as the idealist would say, that's right, you need something backing your currency and you don't want people playing games with it. But the Swiss National Bank has made a public commitment to peg the Swiss franc to the euro at roughly 1.2 to 1. And that relationship they need and guard for the sake of manufacturing viability. They need to maintain the export and compete in the global economy with a currency that is relatively cheap or cheaper than it would be otherwise. So the notion that they can never sell a gold ounce in order to defend that peg went over very poorly with the voter. The voter recognized the need to maintain fuller employment and maintain growth in the economy via a weaker currency. And this is, I think, something that could have been addressed in a very different way had they given some flexibility, given perhaps a band, an amount which they could liquidate in a certain time frame, no more, no less. But to say, no, we will never, ever, ever, ever sell an ounce of gold once we've reached that 20% mark, that's what killed it.
It was written really not to pass, but to, I guess, make a statement. Yeah, I'd like to read a quote, Dave. You probably read this yesterday. A regular guest of ours, Bill King, is talking about this lack of real physical gold and this demand quietly of the sovereign nations bringing it home. And here's what he said. He said, sovereigns, under the strain of unserviceable debt and unaffordable welfare, are issuing ginormous amounts of debt to central banks and investors. Now, some sovereigns are doing the other leg of the trade, grabbing for the gold. Some leaders obviously see solid reasons to grab for the gold. And here's how he ends that. He says, when the global central bank sovereign bond corner ends, there will be insatiable demand for gold. We're not talking about contracts here. We're talking about physical gold, aren't we?
We are talking about physical gold. We're not talking about anything other than the physical gold. And what kind of a time frame is that? There is the system of Ponzi finance, which we have today, held together by baling wire and chewing gum. And I suppose you could argue it goes one leg further. But we're on borrowed time already. What do I mean by borrowed time? And listen, we've gone from 2001 at $5.8 trillion in national debt to 2014. We've just started fiscal 2015, and we're at $17.9 trillion. Let's call it $18 trillion in debt. And by the way, last Wednesday, just before the Thanksgiving holiday, the Treasury had to issue over $1 trillion in new debt just to refinance and pay off the old debt. Talk about a system of Ponzi finance. It's getting to the point of absurd, and yet the general perception in the marketplace is peace, calm. Everyone in the higher echelons of the world of elite finance have this all in hand. And I agree with Bill King. When this corner in central bank game playing ends and you no longer can sustain Italian debt at 2%, no longer can sustain Austrian debt at less than 1%, Dutch debt at less than 1%, Irish debt at less than 1.4%. When these become absurd, and they are absurd, but when the market recognizes them as absurd, that is the stampede. That's the stampede and it's the final move in terms of gold's long-term structural bull market. How can I even describe that as a bull market in the context of price decline? Listen, we've had the Dow move up 38% since the year 2000. We still have gold up 223% in the same time frame. In terms of bull market dynamics, gold has every fundamental at its back. The fact that you've had 3 years of weak pricing, who cares? With any amount of perspective, you realize just how dangerous we're at. A grand financial experiment, there's shades of familiarity where central banks and central planners have tried to do things like this, never to this scale, but have tried to do things like this in the past, and it's failed miserably. Somehow we're convinced that because the scale is so much bigger this time around, that the result is going to be better. And I think that defines foolishness, and I think ultimately that defines a catastrophic ignorance, which will destroy people's finances.
Well, I think one of the things that's difficult, Dave, you know, you put it in perspective when we look back at the last 13, 14, 15 years. In fact, I look back at the last three decades almost that I've been here. You know, gold goes up and down, but gold goes more up than down, period, because governments keep printing money. So, yes, it goes up and down. The timing thing, though, people ask, okay, well, what's the timing? Last week, you know, you had Charles Ninner on it. The idea with having Charles there is he says, okay, I'm a man who does timing. Now, he thinks timing is right for gold. So using just that cyclical system, he said timing's right. But going back to the analogy, Dave, let's say we're on the deck of the Titanic. We've heard the iceberg hit. Nobody's really putting life jackets on yet, except for a few informed souls. Let's say maybe central banks, you know, getting their gold back, what have you. But really, there's not a general panic going on at this point. I think the difficulty for people is to say, well, if I knew the timing when this thing would sink, then I would know when to put my life jacket on. But that's completely impractical, isn't it?
Just put it on and forget about it. The reality is you cannot have perfect timing. And I think Buffett is very in tune with this concept. Timing never has to be perfect. The trend, you should identify a trend. And certainly if you can identify value, then you've got two things that fight for significantly higher prices and returns in the future. Kevin, we have a deflationary collapse in our midst. And we have central banks who are running printing presses a la the hyperinflationary 1920s in Germany. And that contrast is very difficult for people to grasp, that you can have both and instead of either or. And the central banks are doing everything that they can to maintain the status quo, while the markets themselves are telling you that it's not working. It's not working. It's not working. The edifice of debt is simply too large, and it has to and is imploding. Look, oil at these levels is sending a very clear message. We've talked about the canary in the coal mines in terms of deflation, and copper dropping 6% this last week to the lowest level since 2010 and below the critical $3 a pound level. That's significant. We've talked about the Canadian currency. We've talked about the Australian currency. These are signs and symptoms of emerging market and commodity sensitive economies, which depend on growth in the global economy for their products and goods to be purchased en masse. And it's not happening. It's simply not happening. So when we started out by saying, you know, yes, we have a price war with OPEC, but guess what else we have? We also have lack of demand. At the same time, there's an increase in supply on the oil front. We also have lack of demand, and that is an indication of a slowly grinding down global economy. We've got to pay attention to this. We've got to pay attention to the emerging market weakness. Debt markets in the emerging markets have been terrible for the last several weeks. Copper, sending a very clear message. Your emerging market currencies, sending a very clear message. Oil, sending a very clear message. And I think the central banks who have figured out that this is not going to be a game that they win, they're doing exactly what the Dutch are doing. They're doing exactly what the Germans began a year or two ago. They're moving for the gold because they know that in the process of rebuilding an economy, they're going to need to do that. And their legitimacy, the legitimacy of their currency, future tense, will depend on their basis, will depend on their foundation. And ultimately, when trust founders, guess what you come back to? Guess what sociologically, psychologically, financially speaking, becomes again the bedrock for a new growth cycle in terms of the global economy? When trust founders, people go back to gold. It's really quite that simple. So when does trust founder? Listen, I think we're seeing it in fits and starts all over the world. And again, as you suggested, Kevin, if you're just waiting for that ideal moment just before you jump into the icy cold water and absolutely must have your life jacket, you already have it on, you need to have your brain checked. You really do. Because, I mean, you're talking about risk mitigation. You're talking about insurance. You're not talking about rank speculation on price increase. You're talking about preserving financial assets intergenerationally in a context where these financial stresses and strains have never been witnessed on this scale before. Never.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.